Welcome. I'm Meredith Broadbent, the Schultz Chair in International Business here at CSIS. On behalf of myself and Andrew Kutchins, who's director of our Russia and Eurasia program, I want to welcome you to an important discussion on bilateral relations between the United States and Russia on the eve of the G8 summit meeting and during the period leading up to the vote, we hope, next month in the Russian State Duma to ratify Russia's accession to the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Since 2009, the reset in relations between Russia and the United States, there have been many successes in the relationship, including the New START Treaty, cooperation on Afghanistan, Iran, and North Korea, civilian nuclear power, and other areas. But there have been notable differences over Syria, missile defense, human rights, enforcement of intellectual property rights, and the conduct of parliamentary elections last month. Both President Putin and President Obama have called for a deepening of economic cooperation between the two countries. The Russian State Duma is expected to ratify Russia's accession to the WTO in June or early July. We expect 30 days after that, roughly, that Russia will become a member of the World Trade Organization. For the United States to take advantage of the new market openings in the Russian market, Congress must pass legislation to grant Russia permanent normal trade relations treatment. The panel today will focus on prospects for improving relations with Russia and how the WTO process has prompted Russia to take measures to open its economy to more international trade and investment. We had timed this panel so that it could set the stage for the meeting between President Obama and President Putin on May 18th, which we have just learned has been canceled today. President Putin has decided to forego his trip to the United States for the G8 summit meeting, and we'll hear more about that from our panelists. But with that introduction, I'd like to yield to my colleague, Andrew Kutchins. He's director of our Russia and Eurasia program here at CSIS, and he will moderate today.
Thanks very much, Meredith, for the introduction, and welcome everybody here to CSIS. Delighted to see such a full room and such interest in U.S.-Russia relations, and particularly the economic dimension of it. And we have an absolutely superb group of speakers. So let me make haste and make some brief introductions and then turn the floor over to them to make some remarks. We'll start off with our two ambassadors to each other's country. First of all, the current ambassador from the Russian Federation to my right, Sergei Ivanovich Kislyak, one of the most distinguished and long-serving and successful members of the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He has been here, of course, in Washington since 2008 as ambassador, and he has overseen from the Russian side of things this improvement in relations, often called the reset. He has also served as Russia's ambassador to Brussels and simultaneously Russia's ambassador to NATO, and also as a deputy foreign minister. Mr. Kislyak, it's a wonderful pleasure to see you here at CSIS. Our second speaker will be Ambassador John Byerly, who just returned from a very successful stint in Moscow as our ambassador to the Russian Federation. He arrived back in January of 2012, and he, from the American perspective, was implementing on the ground the improvement of relations and the long series of agreements and cooperation that have developed over the past 3 years between the United States and the Russian Federation. Like Mr. Kislyak, he's one of our longest-serving and most successful and decorated members of the U.S. Foreign Service. He's also served as our ambassador to Bulgaria from 2005 to 2008, and many, many other assignments having to do with the Soviet Union, the Russian Federation, East Central Europe, and Europe. John, great to see you here today.
Thanks.
Our third speaker to my left will be Ambassador Susan Schwab, who served as the United States Trade Representative for several years, beginning in June of 2006. She is currently a professor of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, a place where she actually has quite a long and distinguished history, as you served as the dean of the University of Maryland School of Public Policy for 8 years from 1995 to 2003. And if you read in the biographical material we have on Ambassador Schwab, you'll see a long series of achievements that she made in representing United States in trade negotiations. The only one I'm not seeing there, Susan, is the one, the U.S.-Russia bilateral agreement in November of 2006. maybe it's my oversight. Our final speaker in batting cleanup today will be Klaus Kleinfeld, the CEO of Alcoa, the largest integrated aluminum company in the world, 61,000 employees in 31 countries. That's a big job, Klaus. And he also serves as the chairman of the U.S.-Russia Business Council. And I just want to extend a shout-out to the Business Council and their president, Ed Verona, and their vice president, Randy Levinas, who have been working tirelessly for the Coalition for U.S.-Russia Trade in working on this effort to promote Russia's graduation from the Jackson-Vanik Amendment and being granted permanent normal trade relations status, which we hope will happen sometime soon this year. So with that, let me turn the floor over to Ambassador Byerly.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me, Ambassador Kislyak. My apologies.
Thank you very much, but I wouldn't mind to be the second. First of all, thank you.
Our guest of honor.
I think you are trying to oversell some of my achievements. And I was trying to think, when you said that I'm among the successful ambassadors, I was trying to achieve what is your measurement of success. And I would say that most probably at least one success that I can count to my record will be if PNTR is granted, and if it is granted in a normal, respectful way, which is also important.
Put it on the...
PNTR has a lot of political meaning because PNTR is not granted because of Jackson-Vanik Amendment that was introduced way back in the Cold War time with the disagreements between the Soviet Union and the United States over the Jewish immigration. Since then, we have progressed in our relations with Israel significantly. Israel is a friendly country. We have even abolished the visa regime to each other. So Russians go to Israel without asking for a visa.
I think you probably have to switch the microphone on.
Israelis come to us without applying for a visa. And also, the Israelis are coming back,
those of Russian origin, coming back with ideas, with sometimes money, with technologies, to work in the country that they know very well. And that is quite normal. I would say that we have normalcy in our relations with Israel, but we do not have normalcy of the relation in this particular field with the United States over the issue that is no longer, by all standards. It's still there because there is a political context for this, and most probably we will see, we hear it a lot, a debate as to whether Russia can graduate from the Jackson-Vanik or not. To be honest, in terms of Russian economic interest, the completion of negotiations of entry to the WTO give us an opportunity to become a member pretty soon, before the end of this year. Currently, the situation is that if PNTR is not granted to Russia, that means kind of PNTR reciprocal is not going to be granted to the United States in Russia. And that means that the benefits that the WTO gives to foreign countries entering the Russian market will be less available to our American counterparts than to many others. We do not like that kind of situation. What we think is needed is normalcy in our relation, normalcy. And it's something that is still missing. We try to measure our relations by agreements in arms control, 1-3 agreements that are extremely important in their own right. They give a push to these relations. But what is missing? Normal trade, normal interaction between business communities, not only big companies that have already entered our market and are doing pretty well, or mind you, there are a number of Russian companies that have invested heavily in the United States and doing pretty well. I'll give you a couple of examples, TMK is the biggest producer of tubes in the world. They have become number one, having entered the American market as well. They're the best. They have invested in, I think, four or five facility productions here. Severstal, they also invested in steel mills here. They are well received where they operate in the States. And we consider it to be a step towards normalcy in our relations. I would also say that we are a big market. You are a bigger market. We are a market of 142 million people with the highest income in, it depends on how you qualify the countries with economy in transition or developing countries, but Russian market is very, very significant for all the partners, including those in the United States. And we certainly would stand to benefit from increased cooperation with the United States economically, but also politically. The current numbers, if you look into this, are reflecting our trade, extremely modest. The last year, the trade both ways accounted for $40 billion. Sounds almost impressive. But it's less than 1% of foreign trade of the United States, and it's less than 2-point-something% of Russian foreign trade, which suggests in turn that neither United States nor Russia are to each other an important economic partner. Just for example, with our neighboring Ukraine, our trade is 20% higher. With EU, it's almost 10 times higher. So what it means? It means that we are missing a good economic underpinning for political relations. And that leaves them still vulnerable to the politics of the day, to the crises of the day, and unnecessarily so. We certainly have a lot of things that we have in common in terms of challenges that we face. And I once drew a list of things that unite us. It appeared to me much longer than that on which we do not see eye to eye, and I would submit much more important for Russia and hopefully for the United States. But we have progressed a lot during the last 3 years. Reset has brought a lot of new things, a lot of new way of doing things. The commission that was established by the two presidents seems to be producing new ideas, new avenues for cooperation, both between the governments and also by creating a framework for cooperation of non-governmental operators, be it business-to-business or people-to-people, which is good. And we would like to see it progressing further. But still, the potential that does exist for our partnership is still untapped. And we want it, certainly, to be developed in full, because that benefits us, and hopefully it benefits you. And since our countries have a significant role in defining the world stability and maintaining the world stability, especially in the nuclear field, and we are members of the Security Council, good relations between two of us usually translate into better ability of the international community to focus on international issues of the day. So, what I'm trying to suggest, focusing on the subject matter of today's discussion, economics are important for the sake of economics, for the businesses, for job creation in both countries, but also they are important in terms of building a solid underpinning for our political relations, making our relations less vulnerable for the differences that are unavoidable, that they occur even between the closest allies. But we have learned to work on these issues respectfully to each other, and that's another achievement of the reset. But I think that WTO to us means better and more strong integration of Russian world markets, and American market and American partners in the economic field are among the ones that we would like to develop stronger ties, and hopefully we will. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Kislyak. You know, I was struck when I read Vladimir Putin's campaign article on February 27th in Moskovsky Novosti, the one that dealt with foreign policy, and read the line to the effect that the trade and economic relationship between the United States and the Russian Federation is way underdeveloped. And this is something that we need to devote a lot more attention to.
I agree.
Paraphrasing what you said, and which also sounds like a talking point right out of the State Department. So let me transition to you, John Byerly.
Andy, thanks very much, and thanks to CSIS for convening this very, very timely panel. As the U.S. ambassador to Russia for the past 3.5 years up until January of this year, I was often asked, what exactly is the reset about? And I don't think I could put it any better than my friend Sergei just put it. It's about a much more normal relationship between the United States and Russia, a more constructive and a more productive relationship. I've worked most of my career in the State Department and even before trying to help foster that more constructive and more productive approach, and I was very fortunate over the past 3.5 years to be able to play a part in some of the successes that Sergei and Andy talked about. I recall early on when President Obama first took office and reached out to President Medvedev, first in a letter, then a phone call, and then in the early meeting, making clear that for the United States, the reset was not just about improving the tone of the relationship, which had gotten a bit scratchy, frankly, in the years before he took office. It was also about a substantive agenda which would fundamentally improve living standards and the lot of people in both countries. And clearly, the START Treaty, the cooperation that the United States and Russia achieved on Afghanistan, in particular Russia's support for American supply of its forces in Afghanistan, those are two signal accomplishments that I think signaled very early on that both countries were serious about getting back to business and recapturing the habits of cooperation which had atrophied. But probably the most difficult goal that the two presidents set for themselves, they set fairly early, and that was WTO. WTO accession, WTO membership for Russia did not depend on the United States alone. Obviously, it depended mostly on actions that Russia itself needed to take. But President Obama made very, very clear in some of his early meetings with President Medvedev that he was willing to go the extra mile to work with our European allies, to work with the U.S. Congress, to work with the U.S. business community to ensure that everyone saw the benefits of WTO accession for Russia. The fact that Russia was the only country in the G20 and the G8 not in the WTO seemed to President Obama to be incomprehensible. And I remember very clearly, and Sergei, you were in the meeting with me, when President Obama and President Medvedev met in the summer of 2010 in the cabinet room and discussed the need to really get down to business and push this across the finish line in a very, very short time frame. The presidents turned to their advisors and said, we're going to go to lunch now, and we want you to come up with the plan that will make Russian membership in WTO a reality after 18 years. I look out in the audience and I see some of the people here from USTR, Betsy Hafner, who were intimately involved in just about every step of this. The president had a very strong team on his side, obviously led by Ambassador Ron Kirk, and President Medvedev also had a strong team. It was clear to us that First Deputy Premier Shuvalov would have the main responsibility for the legislation that needed to be passed in a very short period of time. And also, it was clear to us that both sides needed to work hard to resolve the problem over chicken exports, which had perennially bedeviled U.S.-Russia trade relations. To make a long story short, as we all know, in the fall of last year, Russia was formally invited to join the WTO. The negotiations were concluded after many, many hours in which Russia, the United States, our European allies all identified the benefits to the world economy, not just to our own economy, not just to Russia's economy, but to the world economy of having Russia as a member of the WTO. This, to me, is the achievement I think that I'm the most proud of playing a small part in, because the dividends from that will continue to pay out for years and even decades to come. As Sergei said, and I couldn't agree with him more, the foundation for a sustainable, productive relationship between the United States and Russia is a strong economic relationship. When I was coming up through the State Department, arms control was the center of gravity. And Sergei and I both labored in the trenches on arms control negotiations for many, many years. And as he said, it's still extremely important. But now a strong commercial relationship, trade and investment, increasing trade volumes between the two countries will create stakeholders on both sides who understand the fundamental importance of this relationship to the world economy, to the world as a whole, and will continue to push forward, sustain the momentum of the reset, and also build on that to reach new achievements in the years to come. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. You know, it is to Vladimir Putin's credit that I don't think that the Russian government really got serious about its WTO accession until he became president back in 2000. And that leads me to turn to you, Susan, as you were directly involved in many of those negotiations for several years. What is your perspective on what this means for Russia and for the WTO?
Well, I must say this has gone on a very long time. Speaking as one who put in several years, and Betsy and others who are in the audience involved and were involved in the bilateral negotiation and the bilateral agreement phase of this. For those of you not familiar with the ins and outs of the WTO accession process, would know that there are two stages. One, and this, by the way, is a miserable, miserable process for any country trying to come into the WTO. This is not easy. This was not easy for Russia, was not easy for Vietnam or Ukraine or any other country, China, when China came in. Being a latecomer to the WTO, you're expected to come in and in 5 or 10 years do what every other country that's a member of the WTO got 50 years to do. So let's put it into some perspective here. I had the opportunity to negotiate on these matters over an extended period of time, and in 2006, November of 2006 to be precise, managed to conclude the bilateral Russia-U.S. Agreement on Russia's accession to the WTO, which is part of a series of bilateral agreements that Russia concluded in advance of the multilateral deal that was concluded last year that paved the way for the situation where we find ourselves today. The short version of my remarks is, one, Russia is going to become a member of the WTO this year. Two, whether the United States graduates Russia from Jackson-Vanik or not. And therefore, three, the sooner the United States can move ahead with our own process so that we can fully take advantage of Russia's joining, becoming a member of the WTO, the better. That's sort of the short version. The slightly longer version is that it's somewhat more complicated than all this, as we know, with implications for the various actors. And I would begin by offering principal kudos and congratulations to the U.S. business community, which has been up on Capitol Hill day in and day out, making the case for why it is in the interest of the United States, as well as in the interest of Russia, for Russia to join the WTO. It is very much in the interest of U.S. Goods, producers of manufactured goods, agricultural exporters, services exporters, for Russia to join the WTO, for Russia to lower its barriers to trade, to have disciplines on its intellectual property protections, for there to be dispute resolution enforcement opportunities. For those of you familiar with a website known as Global Trade Alerts, you know, the G20 in November of 2008, at the front end of the Great Recession, the G20 members all pledged that they weren't going to impose protectionist trade and investment measures. 2 years out, GTA measured that, was able to measure some 431 new protectionist trade and investment barriers that were imposed by G20 members. Of those 431, Russia had imposed 85. Now, of the G20 members, only Russia is not a member of the WTO. I think the two are related. And it is in Russia's interest to be able to have protections for its exports in the world, for Russia to be able to diversify its markets, its production, away from just oil, gas, natural resources. But it is very much in the interest of U.S. producers, U.S. exports. And so first, kudos to the U.S. business community. I have the privilege of sitting on the board of boards of Boeing, of Caterpillar, of FedEx. I know Jim McNerney is up on the Hill in his capacity, in his Boeing capacity, but also as chair of the Business Roundtable, working this. I know Caterpillar's up on the Hill. I see Scott Miller from Procter & Gamble very much present working the Congress on this. But quite frankly, the business community can't do this by itself. Chairman Baucus of the Senate Finance Committee, Chairman Camp of the House Ways and Means Committee, this is bipartisan support for moving PNTR for Russia. They are very much on record for moving it. And if it is going to happen, the sooner the better. So what next steps? Well, if this is going to happen, the sooner the better. This is a June-July equation that we should be talking about here. And for that, we really need the White House to be stepping up and to engage with the leadership in the Congress to work to make sure that the votes are there. And here we get into the issue that, and this is sort of the awkward moment for me. I am an economist. I am a trade policy person. I am not a foreign policy person. I am not a human rights person. But I am told by everyone who is counting noses on Capitol Hill that the way that this legislation is going to move is that at some point in parallel, there will be some other kind of legislation moving in the human rights area. This is not my lane. This is what I'm told. This is what I read. If that is the case, then the White House needs to be up on the Hill working that part of the equation and doing it promptly and doing it with the decision makers who are going to be making those decisions as well. So I put that out there because nobody else has yet. And so the sooner the better.
Thank you very much for those inspiring words and putting it out there. I think we'll continue to follow up on that. Klaus, you've also been on the barricades on this issue, and I think you've seen up close and personal probably through your long career with Siemens before and also now with Alcoa. What, you know, foreign companies' engagement with Russia means, what sort of changes have taken place over the past years, and what you see this most recent development possibly doing for Russia.
Yeah, let me give you basically four views. The first thing is what has happened on the commercial side. Second thing is not everything is rosy, right, and what needs to happen, and we should be open about it, and we have been open about it. Third thing is what are the opportunities, and there are plenty. And last thing is connecting to what you said before is what needs to be done now together. I think you are absolutely right. It has to be done jointly between the political as well as the business community. The business community has a clear view on that. So on the commercial side, I think you can't deny saying a lot of progress has been made. And human memory is usually very short. And frankly, if you just look at the things that have happened over, I would say, the last 3 years, this is an unbelievable success. Right? I mean, let's start with, we have had since the reset has been announced, four meetings, CEO to CEO dialogues, and they have been super successful, right, from both sides. If you look at the investment side of things, large investments have been made. I mean, we as Alcoa have invested almost $1 billion over there, and really successfully. We've just recently seen Pepsi investing $1 billion, buying a company, Coca-Cola making a commitment for $3 billion over 5 years, the Exxon Rosneft deal, $500 million over a decade. So Ford and Solaris joint venture and could go on $1.4 billion. This is not small change. This is big, and we shouldn't just consider that as normal. You know, it is normal if it were a normal place, but under the conditions we have been operating under, it's actually pretty spectacular, I would say. So the business community has already voted. Business community says we got to do business there, right? And it's working out. I mean, we wouldn't put our money behind there, and others wouldn't if they wouldn't see that there's great opportunities today, not just tomorrow, today. And for most, it has worked out very, very well. You've seen also from the Russian side, they put this investment fund together and capitalized it well with $10 billion. That's a pretty cool thing over 5 years. Not many places have been able to do that. So that's all good. Little things in quotation marks, like three-year multiple entry visas, you know, now we have it. We've always complaining about it. I mean, both of you, big-time involvement, and thank you very much to both of you. Always had a great open ear, you know, fantastic job. You know, highly qualified immigrants, work visas can be achieved in 20 days. All of these things are great. And one thing that probably hasn't gotten noticed so much, the business community has always said, particularly for those ones that are new in Russia, not those ones that have been dealing there for many, many years. What do we do when we run into issues in the provinces? And the argument from the Russian leadership has always been, my God, the country is really big, right? And we don't know all the things that are going on there. And then we came up with a suggestion, actually in a good cooperation, why don't you establish a hotline? That's how it originally evolved, and the hotline became an ombudsman. And the ombudsman was the first Deputy Prime Minister Shuvalov. And that, I mean, if you listen to the business community there over what has worked very, very well, it's particularly those ones that enter newly into Russia to have a hotline which they can go to, elevate an issue, and the issue is taken serious and in most cases very nicely resolved. So that's happening, and I think we should not ignore that. We should also not ignore, and let me come to my second point, that the picture isn't as rosy as you could walk away with just looking at that. And I try to be as objective as possible and not to step on anybody's foot here. I mean, you have some indices like Transparency International that is kind of considered as a good indication for transparency. I mean, Russia in 2011 has made it to the whopping position of 143 out of 182 countries on the same level than Nigeria and Uganda. I mean, knowing the aspirations of most Russians that I've been dealing with, I cannot believe that that is what anybody is aspiring for. World Bank has come out in 2011, ease of doing business, and it's the fantastic position of 129 out of 183, right? It's on the same level than Bangladesh and Nicaragua. I don't think I need to say more. The Commerce Department has just come out on the IP protection, right, with a list and basically has put Russia as the least IPR protection for 16 years in a row. That's all not good. That's all, I would say, I mean, as a business person, room for improvement, big time room for improvement. We in our, and I've mentioned that a couple of times, we in our facility in Samara last year had to file 88,000 pages for the tax authorities. That's a substantial improvement to the year before where it was over 100,000 pages, right? Now, the good news is when those things work, but they work slowly, there's now a process in place to change this over to an electronic system, and we will be one of the first that will be trying this out, and I'm relatively optimistic that this will work out. But this is the non-rosy side. So let me move on to the opportunities, because I mean, I think the business side wouldn't be as excited. It wouldn't be going up to the hill and basically saying, look, let's use this opportunity that has not been around for the last 18 years. Now W accession is there. This is now about us. It's about jobs and business in the U.S. PNTR has nothing to do really with Russia. This is about U.S. business profiting from it, right? And the Export Council of the president has done a very, very good job in looking at export opportunities, and they came out with a nice study saying, well, we can double exports from the U.S. to Russia in the next 4 to 5 years, with the PNTR status. And having looked at that, that's pretty credible. We have done, with a coalition that we founded dealing with the U.S.-Russian business side, we have done a profile by each state and basically put a radar together what businesses are in each state that today have business with Russia, that are exporting to Russia. So we have it by state. And it's pretty fascinating to see this. I mean, if you go, I have two states, the numbers from two states here. New York exported goods in 2011 of about $500 million to Russia. And there's 1,400 jobs behind it. So basically doubling it would mean the state of New York 1,400 jobs more. If you go to California, the number is $665 million of exports in the last year, and it's 2,000 jobs behind it, would double. I mean, can anybody really say today that we can afford to leave this on the table? And the other thing is, can you really think, oh, you know, we don't decide today. We probably have a chance to do it next spring. And that's a total misassessment of how competition is today, because there are other companies that are at other places in the world that would that are prepared to jump in immediately and basically take the opportunity. So I mean, if it needs more convincing, the arguments I think are very, very clear, and the business side is totally convinced. And I give you reasons why. I mean, John Deere, Sam Allen has been very clear about that and educated all of us in the business community that are not in that sector. He says 9% of the world's arable land is in Russia, 8% of the fresh water, 20% of the forest area, right? And this is, and then you say, you look at the automation, the degree of automation in the farming, and he believes very strongly, and we've looked at that and think it's credible, that you can double the grain output per land, you know, if you automate it more. And so that's the opportunities that I'm talking about. This are the export. Tractors, exactly, you know, and basically just getting more out of it. And so the auto industry, I didn't know that, actually. I mean, GM Chevrolet is currently the top-selling foreign brand in Russia. Did you know that? I didn't know that. Thinking about all the fallout that was there, you know. So this is my third point. The fourth point is the question to Susan and what everybody else has addressed, what needs to be done? I think it's absolutely clear. I mean, we want to hear, and we have heard, but we'd like to hear it now from the new administration, an absolutely unquestioned commitment to the modernization, right? Because that's what I believe Russia needs, and that's what the business community needs. And that has a couple of facets, but I think it would be good to clearly have that from the new leadership, clearly made that statement from the new leadership. We've heard it through some of the people that will be playing most likely a role in the administration, but it would be really important to hear it almost as a first message to the business community, a clear commitment from the new leadership towards modernization. And that also has the implication of good opportunities for business. The second thing is PNTR. I think it's no question, I said it before, we need to make sure PNTR gets passed. We've had over 100 meetings, the coalition had over 100 meetings on the Hill. You're right, I mean, there is no support from a number of important things. I talked to Senator Baucus this afternoon, I talked to him a couple of times, but I think he's behind it, and others are too, so this is all good. You mentioned Dave Camp, very, very good. I think you're absolutely right to also address the elephant in the room, right? And I totally agree with you, Susan. I mean, this is critically important. It's also not my point to make it, but we have to be realistic that these things, if they go in parallel, will politically be seen as one. And I close it with that.
Thanks very much, Klaus. Following up on the points that you were both making, that granting Russia PNTR, as Senator Baucus put it recently at a hearing of the Finance Committee, it's a slam dunk. I mean, the argument from the economic commercial argument standpoint of U.S. national interest, it is a slam dunk. I wrote a piece last week where, in a very intellectual way, I concluded that it would be idiotic for the United States not.
Technical term, Matt.
Yeah, very highly technical and academic term. around the bush. But there are two problems. One is that this is a campaign year here, and so getting congressmen and senators to make a vote that will be viewed by many as doing something positive for Russia, when in fact it is doing something positive for the United States,
exactly,
is a challenge. And two, while the economic argument is clear, this is not just going to be about an economic argument. I think this is going to be a broad referendum about Russia. And that takes us back to, I think, to the realm of our ambassadors, that, you know, what is the argument to make about, I think there's a very strong argument to make about how improved relations with the Russian Federation have in fact served U.S. national interests and Russian national interests. You know, John, how would you characterize that argument in a nutshell that would, you know, put this in a different light?
Well, I think it's clear that we, the United States, want to see a strong, democratic, Russia that has an economy that's producing for its people. That's the kind of partner that we need in the 21st century. And that means that we, like many Russians that we know, many Russian citizens, have a stake in seeing institutions built inside of Russia that make Russia a stronger, more sustainable polity. There's just no question that that's in our interest. And we go about that in many different ways. As I said, I think the central way is trying to build a stronger economic relationship with Russia, because it's good for both countries, and it also serves as something of a shock absorber for the political cycles, the ups and downs that we see periodically. I think it means that we need to speak very frankly, as we do in private, when we see things happening in Russia that we think perhaps aren't leading it to that stronger, more democratic, more stable future. This, in the end, depends on the Russian people themselves and on Russian leaders. But if we as Americans are making it clear to the Russians that we see them as a desirable, strong partner, and that our desire to see them strengthen their institutions is really just part of what we've stood for as a nation for 200 years, then I think perhaps some of the scratchiness, some of the unpleasantness that sometimes attended this dialogue back and forth can go away. How that plays out exactly in the context of lifting the Jackson-Vanik Amendment and granting PNTR to Russia, we're going to have to see. The administration is committed to seeing Jackson-Vanik lifted, to granting PNTR to Russia, and we're committed to working with Congress to do this in a way that is good for the U.S.-Russia relationship going forward for years and decades to come.
Ambassador Kistak?
Do you want me to interfere in the internal political debates in the U.S.? You're not going to draw me into that.
I'll let you know after I hear what you say.
I'll tell you a couple of things. One, we are big, self-reliant country, respecting our partners, and we certainly insist that our partners respect us. The way that sometimes people try to teach others what is good or what is wrong in Russia for Russians sometimes goes beyond something we can accept. I pick up the argument that John left us with, and that is the goal should be PNTR. It's not PNTR for Russia, to be honest. It's PNTR for American business in Russia. And you need to understand that, because we have been invited to WTO. We are going to be there the moment the documents are ratified in Russia. Whether United States give us PNTR or not, it's not something that we want to continue for several reasons. First, we want Americans to be our good partners. Secondly, politically, it's one of the vestiges of the Cold War mentality that is still with us and spoils political environment for the reasons which one cannot even explain today, because the reasons why Jackson Vanik appeared in the first place, however it was wrong even at that time, are no longer. So what is left as a vestige of the Cold War is still with us, and it's a reflection of a wider problem in our relations. The Cold War mentality that sometimes still persists. As one of my American colleagues said to me, that we are victims of the post-Cold War hangover, which is right. Very frequently we judge each other through the stereotypes that had been developed then and not through the commonality of purpose that we have today. And it's extremely important. We want to work with the Americans. We want to do business with the Americans. We want you to be present in the Russian market. We stand to benefit from partnership with American companies. Like our companies are eyeing the American market more and more, and we plan to diversify the economy. And Mr. Kleinfeld said that it would be very important for us to recommit ourselves. I can tell you it's something that we are fully committed to, and we are going to continue. That's not because the American business wants to do it, because it's something that we need and decided that we want to do for the benefit of Russian economy, for the benefit of the Russian people. We are a rich country. We are rich in everything. We have the table of Mendeleev, all of it under our feet in Russia. We have well-educated people, excellent engineers, mathematicians, physicists, and we now have a new breed of managers. Most probably you would be able to confirm that all the companies that are working in Russia now extensively rely on Russian management. We have a new generation of people who are entering the market economy. Mind you, we are still a young market economy. Just try to imagine, it's only around 20 years. And try to look at the United States 20 years after adoption of Constitution. I would say that we are extremely proud of what we have been able to achieve. But we are continuing. We have defaults in the way we apply sometimes the rules we ourselves develop, and we are working on them. There have been a number of things that have been recently introduced in order to make our democracy more modernized, more adapted to the wish of the people as a result of political debate that is more and more lively in Russia, which is also normal. So whatever is happening in Russia is because we do it for ourselves, not because we are told to by Americans or anybody else. I think that what we have been doing in Russia is fully in line with your ability to work with us as a real partners. And if that is not the case, and I once again would like to draw your attention to what John said, and I fully agree with you, that PNTR needs to be granted in a way that wouldn't undermine Russian-American relations. And Ambassador Schwartz referred to the parallel legislation. We all know what it is. However, I do not know the final version of what it's going to be. We know the what is behind it. And I will tell you upfront that if that kind of legislation is adopted, it will deal a significant blow to our ability to work in a number of areas, because we will be working with the United States in as much as the United States is willing to work with us in a respectful, mutually beneficial way. I think that the opportunities are great. And unless somebody wants to torpedo that kind of opportunities to be materialized, we can do it.
So the unmentioned piece of legislation goes by the moniker of the Magnitsky Act. Google it. I have some concern that the administration is shying away from a debate, seeing a public debate on Russian policy during a campaign year, and I don't think that they should. I think there are a lot of very positive data points you can point to how things that Russia has done have really served U.S. interests. Now, one of the little less known ones has to do actually with the new transit corridors, and not so new now, the transit corridors to supply U.S. Troops and forces in Afghanistan, in which the Russian Federation plays a key role. 3.5 years ago, our troops in Afghanistan were all being supplied through the port of Karachi in Pakistan and through two, what the military calls ground locks of communication, G-locks, that get into Afghanistan, right on the Afghan-Pak border. Until 3 years ago, we were totally dependent upon that that supply line. With the opening up of new supply lines that go through the Caspian states, Central Asia, and Russia, that made us, we had less vulnerable to whatever might happen in Pakistan, whatever might happen in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. Now, there's been a little political sparring in the last couple of weeks about killing Osama bin Laden and the advisability of who said what on the campaign trail. All I can say is that a year ago May, if we didn't have those other ground locks of communication and the cooperation from the Russian Federation, the calculation about whether to carry out that strike on Osama bin Laden would have been very different. And you might have found more opposition in the room than just Defense Secretary Gates at the time in a different decision. So with that, I think we have about 15 minutes or so for questions and discussions with the audience. So there are microphones around the room. Please raise your hand. Note your affiliation, and limit yourself to one brief question. Thank you. Yes.
Jesse Ransom with the Public International on Policy Group. Could you just briefly talk on Syria and how that's affecting U.S.-Russia relations and how that potentially could affect the U.S.-Russia WTO discussions as well?
John, you want to take a crack at that one?
Well, we all see what's happening in Syria with increasing alarm. We've been watching this develop, I wouldn't say in slow motion, over the last 6 to 8 months. It's quite appalling. We are, as a government, determined to see the killing end and to see stability return to that part of the world and to Syria in particular. But to do this, the United States needs to work in concert with our allies. We need to work in concert, in particular, with those countries in the United Nations that form with us, the P5. Russia, I think, shares the goal. I won't speak for Sergei, I'll let him speak, but I think, broadly speaking, Russia shares the goal of stability and an end to violence. So we share a strategic vision of what's happening in Syria, but we've had some disagreement on the tactics that we should take to bring that about. We are committed to continuing to do everything in our power to end the violence, to see an orderly succession take place. We have made very, very clear that we think President Assad's time has come and gone. And we hope very, very much that through the dialogue that we've had with Russia and with our other partners in New York, that we will continue to find ways to hasten that kind of a change and transition so that the people in Syria can live normal lives free from fear, free from violence.
I will add to that that we want violence ceased. We want political dialogue of all the sides in Syria to be engaging and successful, because we do not believe that anybody, be it in Washington or in Europe or in Moscow, can or should tell the Syrians as to how they need to live further and who is going to be the next president. It needs to be done by the Syrians themselves for obvious reasons, because they are, have to decide their own future, and we need to be able to recognize it, all of us. So the difference was, especially in the initial stage, as to how you approach all these issues. Currently, I think we have a little bit more of the common ground, because both the United States and Russia supports the so-called Kofi Annan plan as the basis for immediate steps to be taking in Syria. And then we'll see how the political dialogue and political process can be organized in this country. But we insist it needs to be done by the Syrians themselves and not to be dictated from outside.
Okay, get more topics on the table.
The second part of the question was how it affects Russian-American relations. I would say that it's one of the issues on which we do not see eye to eye, but at the same time it doesn't undermine our ability to work on issues where we do agree. And here I think we have a little bit more normalcy in our relations. Disagreements occur, especially on issues that are very explosive and important to both countries. But at all points, even at the points of significant disagreements, I think we had pretty open and respectful dialogue on this issue.
Thanks. Yes, we'll collect two, three questions. Yes, right here in the front. Then over there to the left.
Lloyd Hanking in Spalding. Dr. Gutsches, let me put this question to you. I've been listening very carefully, and it's very clear to me that there's a consensus that we should grant PNTR. I've gathered that the White House should speak out a little more forcefully at that point. What isn't clear, I realize the discussion has sensitivities, nuances, diplomatic niceties, but perhaps you could articulate sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, what are the specific objections? And if you don't want to say who in the Congress is opposing, just sort of the groups so we can get a clearer idea of what are the objections, if you would please.
Okay. Thank you. I will be happy to do that. Yes. Oh, yeah, this gentleman, right? Well, he's got the microphone, then we'll go back to him.
Chris Kane, Mercator 21. If I'm correct, there has been a bilateral investment treaty negotiated and agreed to by both the Russian government and the United States government, but not ratified. Is that not true? I'd like to know the status of the U.S.-Russian bilateral investment treaty.
I'll repeat very I will answer very briefly. We have been offering to our American colleagues the idea of sitting together and developing this agreement, because absence of such agreement is a big handicap for development of long-term relations. And the argument of our American colleagues was that they were rethinking the strategic approach to that kind of agreements, not as applied to Russia, but most probably as applied to the rest of the world. My sense is that our American colleagues are now a little bit more ready to engage, and we are looking forward to that.
We should have a bilateral investment treaty. We should certainly have BIT negotiations. The administration just finally came up with its model BIT, so maybe we can engage with Russia and a number of other countries on BIT negotiations.
Okay, let me just, before you get back to the, that's fine. I'll try to address your question, and anyone can jump in. I'm sure our official representatives will be thrilled to do so. One of the advantages of working in a think tank is you can say whatever you want. I have no constraints. Okay, one set of objections comes from people who are concerned about human rights and democracy and deficiencies perceived in Russia in those areas. And this is where the case, of course, Sergei Magnitsky, the lawyer who died while he was being held in prison, and concerns about that. Won't go deeply into the case, but there's a whole set of concerns there. The way the parliamentary elections have been held, the presidential elections, et cetera. That's one constituency, okay? A second constituency would be those that are concerned that Russia is pursuing certain foreign policies that are counter to U.S. interests. So they'll point to the disagreement about Syria. There's no question that the Syria issue has seriously poisoned Russia's perception, reputation on Capitol Hill right now, because it's just such a big issue on the headlines. Our inability to come to an agreement about missile defense, aspects of Russia's relationship with Iran, while in fact actually I think that our cooperation with the Russians on Iran has been quite extensive. But there are a whole series of concerns that people will have there about aspects of Russian foreign and security policy, and then I think pertinent to the to Susan and Klaus's area, There are concerns about how Russia does business. There are concerns about whether Russia will actually live up to the WTO commitments that it has made, and that whether adequate I hate to use this word, concessions were made in the negotiations as part of the agreement on intellectual property rights, on phytosanitary standards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's sort of broadly these three constituencies that have various objections for different reasons to Russia's granting Russian PNTR status. Anybody want to jump in on that one?
Well, I'm certainly not the one who will be defining the arguments against Russian graduation. I would say that when I listen to that, I understand, yeah. And I've heard all of this.
all too often. Yeah.
But when I listen to that kind of arguments, I ask myself, what is it? Are we still in the Cold War? Are we in a relationship where the United States is supposed to teach the younger brother how to live? That is wrong. What that kind of logic can lead to is denial of graduation. So be it. Be it. We will leave further. We'll go on and develop our partnership with the Europeans. They are the biggest economic partner, much greater than the United States. We will develop our relations with our immediate neighbors, but it will be the choice of American people. If they do not want to work with us, it's their choice. If they want to work with us, it first needs to be based on mutual respect, and the Magnitsky legislation is a flagrant rejection of mutual respect as far as we're concerned. And it needs to be based on mutual benefit, because that is the most reliable underpinning for any cooperation, especially when you talk about long term. We respect the business of the United States that is interested to make money and to make business in Russia, and it's wonderful because we know what our partners want, and when we feel that what they want is fully in line with the goals of developing a Russian economy, creating jobs, we welcome this. And when it comes to the business environment in Russia, mind you, 20 years in market economy, and I think we are doing excellent job of developing a market that hasn't existed in the huge space of Russia for generations and generations. And it's not only to create new laws. You need also to create a new mentality among people. And mind you, not everybody accepts even the notion of market economy. There is a stronger position in the parliament that is still do not want us to proceed with further privatization and things like that. And it's normal because people have views and they are different. But the overall direction that Russia has taken, I think, is certainly very reliably democratic and market economy, and I'm very proud of what we have accomplished so far. And as to the business environment, I think it's much better than it is described sometimes by company working in Russia, even very respectful companies. I'll tell you, when I was appointed ambassador here, I have a meeting with a number of the heads of Russian affiliates of American companies. I wanted to understand how they feel in Russia. All of them, the ones I've met, all of them said that they know how to operate it. They make excellent business there. They want to stay. Not a single one told me that they are reconsidering. And I even joked why in the world they didn't go to the United States and do not explain how well it is to do business in Russia, how good is it. And some joke that they do not want additional competition. But what I'm suggesting is that companies that have entered, American companies like others, have entered the Russian market with honest and serious proposals for business there, like Alcoa and some others, they are doing pretty well, and they are well respected. It doesn't come without overcoming problems, but show me a market where there is no problem, including here in the United States. I've been talking to Russian companies operating here. Overall, they feel comfortable. When you ask them, have you experienced some problems? Some of them say, oh, yes. But it's also normal, because the other companies that operate in the United States have the same problems. They need to abide by the laws. They need to abide by the accounting procedures. Sometimes it's something that is new to them. And it's entering in the market. It's a serious proposition. But everybody told me, among the people I've spoken to, that the moment you enter the Russian market and you understand it, they feel pretty reliably comfortable.
You know, Susan, one of the objections I've heard has had to do with China's WTO accession, and that the experience of China's WTO accession has raised some concerns about what to expect from Russia. From your perspective, what have we learned from the experience of negotiating China's entry into the WTO?
Well, I mean, one of the things you learn as a trade negotiator is you can always second-guess your predecessor's deal.
Monday morning quarterbacking.
Monday morning quarterbacking is alive and well in any trade negotiation. So you can always think of things that you would have done differently, right, had it been your negotiation. That said, I think that most objective observers, if you had to sit today and contemplate what the world and the trading system would look like today if China were on the outside of the trading system, or if China were on the inside of the trading system and the U.S. hadn't granted China PNTR, we would all be in much worse shape. The U.S. would be in much worse shape, and China would be in worse shape. And similarly, it is both in, back to point one, it is in the U.S. interest and in Russia's interest for Russia to be joining the WTO and for the U.S. to be benefiting from Russia's entry into the WTO, and that will only take place when PNTR is history, when PNTR is granted and Jackson-Vanik is history. I would say something, though, which is I would offer the following observation, because I think you're the three baskets of objections that you described, I think those are accurate baskets. This is a complex bilateral relationship, but I do agree with the ambassador that we need and we should be at the point where we can navigate a complex bilateral relationship in some sort of normalcy, and that should enable us to have a healthy bilateral economic relationship, economic and commercial relationship, and still be working our way through complex foreign policy disagreements. Now, I'm speaking as a former U.S. cabinet official who went around the world listening to individuals around the world, always second-guessing U.S. politics. Okay, everyone in the world has an opinion about U.S. politics and our economics, but it just sort of comes with the territory. You get used to it, trust me. Yep. You do get used to it.
We also do.
Yes, you just get used to it, and so I would say it would be. It is also in Russia's interest for U.S. businesses to be active participants in the Russian market. And U.S. businesses, as I noted, are very actively engaged on Capitol Hill and at the White House and in the State Department saying, let's get PNTR done, because they recognize the importance of this. So it would be a real shame if the most vocal and the most active advocates of Russia's accession to the WTO in the United States were somehow punished by Russian SPS or government procurement actions or some other kinds of actions, out of some fit of pique if the timing was off. Because I would say, you know, you heard it here, I would predict PNTR is going to happen. You know, just as Russia will be a member of the WTO, and the Congress of the United States is going to move PNTR. The only question is one of timing. Is it going to be July? Is it going to be after July? I hope it'll be July, and I know the business community is working very hard to get that done. I would also predict it will be in parallel with another piece of legislation. That's out of my lane, because that's not my field of expertise. And I just think that you know, I leave that to the high foreign policy types, and you guys are used to dealing with much more complicated issues than this. And, you know, put on your big boy pants and figure out how to do it, and the relationship will survive.
We have had enough already.
Klaus, did you want to weigh in?
Well, I can only say from the business side, I think it's really a very simple thing. Number one, WTO gives us a level playing field, which I think, I mean, if you look at what has been one of the largest wealth creation engines, by far larger than any, I mean, development program that any country or countries together have been creating, is globalization, right? And here we're bringing another country onto that system. We're opening it. We have conflict resolution mechanisms that everybody accepts. I mean, you look at the long negotiations, you mentioned some of the, all of that has been concluded in a good fashion. That's very good. Gives us finally what we always wanted, right? And it was an oddity of history that Russia was not on it, in my view. Second thing now, we talked about the export opportunities, right? So, and I would argue, I mean, counter to what I heard here in the room of saying, hey, it's an election year. I would say, yes, it's an election year. Who on this planet can say that we don't need jobs in the U.S.? I mean, it would be out of my mind, you know, to see that anybody can say we're leaving that on the table. Impossible to imagine, right? And the third thing is, which you get on top of it, and some of you might not understand that, most of the companies these days are global companies, and they are headquartered and based in the U.S., and they are very happy, and they have a great heritage here. But in the end, it's the international competitiveness that decides about how strong they can be anywhere on this planet, and certainly also here in the U.S. And you get that in addition to that through an access to the Russian market. For those that don't understand that, I mean, the Russian automotive market, it's the largest automotive market already today in Europe, right? The largest one, and it's fast growing. And when you go there, you see it. I mean, you compare it to, I mean, 2 years, 3 years ago, when you drive into Moscow, St. Petersburg, you saw all the cars that you wouldn't want to drive. These days, I mean, a lot of cars are cars that you want to drive. And you still see some, this is a good thing, that you don't want to drive. So, and those ones that are driving it look very unhappy. So that's the good news there. That's the good news. And I talked about the farming, and there's thousands of other industries where U.S. companies are extremely well positioned, I mean, to really make the market their own. And the good news is the modernization program is open. It clearly says that, and Ambassador Kislyak, I had stated that I agree with you. And I think it's also an understanding in Russia and in other countries, what do U.S. companies bring to Russia? If I look at when we acquired these two large plants, Samara and Belaya Kalitva, we have a very strong safety culture. We are recognized as one of the best safety cultures on this planet. I mean, so the culture in Russia, as we know, has not been a safety culture. If you look at today we have the safety numbers in Samara as well as in Belaya Kalitva on the level of all of our plants. I tell you what, that was an extremely hard job. It requires a level of detail and education, of training with the people. It was nightmarish, but that's the change that we bring. That's the change. And I tell you, a person that changes the behavior and their work like that, I mean, number one, feels more respected, to your point, right? Number two, is not giving that up when they go into their private space. We have, just last week, we had our annual shareholder meeting, and we have a practice which we call a month of service. It's every October worldwide, where we ask our employees to give back to the communities. When we started that and in Russia, everybody said, what is that? I mean, we don't know what that is. I mean, we said, well, we feel that we all should give back to the community, which should be an old Soviet concept, but it really wasn't because everybody thought somebody else has to give back, right? So today, last year in October, we had 56% of all of our Russian employees basically doing work in the communities in addition to their jobs. This idea of volunteerism, and I could go on and on and on and give you examples. This is the value add, and this is what comes with the globalization, with a positive impact. It actually achieves on a political front, it achieves much more in society, much more in society. And that, I think, also is what's behind the whole idea of modernization, because that's what the Russian leaders understand it's needed.
Well, I know there are a lot of other questions and comments in the audience, but I have to be somewhat responsible in my role of moderator so that our guests can get to their next engagement. Susan, I agree with you when you say eventually Russia is going to get PNTR. But you know, it reminds me of what Churchill said about U.S. foreign policy. The Americans always make the right decision after exhausting all the other alternatives. So, on that note, let me thank Klaus, thank Susan, you. Sergey Ivanovich, and John for sharing their thoughts and time with us today. Thank you.